Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On January 20th, the United States and South Korea discovered their first cases of COVID-19. 9 months later, the coronavirus has infected almost 8 million people in the United States. Over 215,000 people have died. South Korea had no significant lockdowns. In a country of 51 million people, only 344 have lost their lives. So how did the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world fail so badly in its response to this global pandemic? Well, over the past 5 months, filmmakers Alex Gibney and today's guests, Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutunian, have been interviewing doctors, scientists, and whistleblowers to get answers. Their new film is called Totally Under Control. On January 22nd, Donald Trump said, quote, "We have it totally under control. It is one person coming from China. It's going to be just fine," end quote. Here is the trailer for the new documentary, Totally Under Control.
The CDC has identified a case of coronavirus in Washington State. The words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and it's going to be just fine. Whatever happens, we're totally prepared.
The scientists knew what to do for the pandemic response. The plan was in front of us, but leadership would not do it. It is time to lay our careers on the line and push back.
It's clear the United States did not perform to the best of its ability with the coronavirus.
Went wrong for us.
The truth is that political leaders caused avoidable death and destruction.
The scientists sounded the alarm every day. The U.S. government was doing nothing.
One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear. It'll be wonderful. It'll be a gift from heaven.
It's complete bull. He has no idea what he's talking about.
Decided to break protocol and alert Americans.
A key government scientist was removed because he wouldn't climb on the president's bandwagon.
They started to blame other people, and it was frightening. There was real fear of retribution, and we were watching the number of deaths in the U.S. tick higher and higher.
Do you take responsibility?
No, I don't take responsibility at all.
We've never had a failure like this.
The truth is finally coming out.
There's so much to expose.
We have it totally under control.
That is the trailer for the new documentary, Totally Under Control. The film is available on demand. Joining us now are Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutunian, directors of the new documentary. Hi, Suzanne and Ophelia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I just wanted to apologize about that pause because we are all in different places because of COVID, and you are all in different places because of COVID. It is so incredible that you were able to pull this off in just 5 months. Suzanne, how did you do it?
We had a really incredible team. I mean, when you make a documentary, you hope all of the, you know, the best of the best you can hire. And luckily, so many of them were available. So we really hit the ground running. We started with production and post-production at the same time. So we were conducting interviews while our editors were, you know, editing archival together. And, you know, it was a real testament to the whole team coming together for common cause.
What would you add, Ophelia?
I mean, there are still team members that we have never met in person. We did this we made the entire film online via Zoom calls and in different states, different places. It is incredible that we pulled this off, honestly, but it really was just the experience of making a film about the pandemic in the pandemic.
And I understand that you used a COVID cam to film this. Can you talk about how you pulled that off? Because the quality is incredible. You'd have no idea that you made this during a pandemic. Suzanne?
Yeah, sure. So our cinematographer, Ben Bloodwell, did some research and basically built from scratch what we call the COVID cam, which is essentially a DSLR camera. So it looks like a still camera, but it records 4K video. Attached that to essentially like a metal tray with handles that you put on a desk, and attached a laptop to that, attached a microphone to that, and we would ship it in a case around the country, and a local assistant camera operator would put it together, drop it off on someone's step, and from there, our cinematographer could completely remotely from his home in another state control the camera, and we could record the interview via Zoom and communicate via Zoom to sort of get the interview subject set up. So that was one way that we were able to record these interviews with complete social distance. And then the other way, if people were more comfortable leaving their homes, several of the interviews we did in sort of clean, sanitized Airbnbs, essentially, where we would send in a single crew member, usually Ben Bloodwell, our DP, or another local camera operator, and they would hang shower curtains and have air purifiers running and, make sure that the place was as clean and sanitized and sort of they had separate air from each other as possible so our interview subject could feel comfortable taking their mask off to talk and also keeping our crew member safe.
Wow. Well, a really amazing job. Thank you so much. We do so many shows about documentaries. In fact, our last documentary, The First Angry Man, about Proposition 13 in California, the filmmakers told us it took them 10 years to make their film. So, I mean, hats off to all of you and your team and all of the background people, because this is such an important film. I watched an interview that the three of you did about the film, and Alex Gibney said one of the reasons why he decided to take on this project is because one of his friends died from COVID and another friend was on a ventilator. Ophelia, what was your response when Alex Gibney reached out to you to work on this film?
Yeah, I mean, we are, both Suzette and I are New York, Brooklyn based. We were living through New York's worst, days. I live next to a hospital, so I would see the freezers and the bodies being rolled out of the hospitals, and we could hear the sirens. And so we were very much in it, and we knew how dangerous this virus was. And so when I was checking in with Alex to see how he was doing, and he said he's thinking about making this film, it just made a lot of sense because we were all feeling so helpless. And as filmmakers, as documentary filmmakers, you always wonder when something like this is happening, like, what can you do? How can you help? And so this was our way of helping, trying to uncover the truth of what went wrong, because we were living through it and we were thinking, this can't be right. There had to have been another way to deal with this pandemic. And so in a way, it was our effort of trying to understand what went wrong for our sanity, but also for the American people.
Mm, wow. Suzanne, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, I had COVID in early March, and luckily I was able to manage it from home, but it was scary. And it was, I had a televisit with my doctor, and I told her my symptoms, and she said, it sounds like you have it. I had been in contact with someone who had tested positive. But in New York at the time, there were not enough tests. And she said, don't go to the hospital and get a test. Don't go get a test. They're not going to give it to you. If you start feeling like you can't breathe, go to the emergency room. And that was terrifying. And I can't imagine being sicker than I was, and so many people were, and being in that circumstance. So it just felt like there were a lot of unanswered questions. But, the information that we really needed about this virus, wasn't getting out to the country.
Wow. So this is really personal for you. Did you have symptoms? Did you get really sick?
I mean, I had a low-grade fever for about 10 days, a lot of body aches, headache. I had a cough. I was on like an inhaler for a few days, but, a lot of symptoms, but again, I mean, I didn't end up going to the hospital, and I was able to recover from home.
You interviewed so many people, from former government officials who became whistleblowers, public health experts, journalists. You interviewed a volunteer from Jared Kushner's COVID-19 supply chain task force, which was very telling. Ophelia, when you all sat down to put this film together, I mean, this is an incredible undertaking. The voices that you brought out were incredible, and you actually bring out so much new information. How did you get so many people to speak on record, and mostly really in secret?
Well, it's always hard to, convince people who are, who have been in the forefront to talk to us in front of the camera while they're still working at these agencies or in the government. We did try to get access to a lot of people, to some people from the CDC, HHS, and the White House, and unfortunately, we never got a yes from them. But the people who did speak to us, I mean, we're so thankful that they did tell their stories in front of our cameras for the American public to see. Being a whistleblower is never easy. It is much harder in this administration. Dr. Bride and Max Kennedy Jr. Had a lot to tell, and it's never easy to put yourself out there and to tell your stories, to put your face out there. But they felt it was important, it was necessary for people to know what actually happened, what went down. I think Max Kennedy Jr., for example, he had released an anonymous whistleblower complaint, but he understood the importance of putting a face with the story and making sure that people know that this is real, that this happened, and we're going to be forever thankful for telling their stories.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Max Kennedy Jr. I mean, this is really an amazing part of the film. So he volunteered for Jared Kushner's task force to secure PPE. It was run by Jared Kushner's college roommate. And Max Kennedy Jr. tells you that they basically gave the volunteers a day to show up to FEMA headquarters. They entered a room with TV screens playing Fox News. They thought they were going to be very low level and do data entry. Much to their surprise, they were actually the team. These were 20-year-old volunteers. They had no experience working with the supply chain. And they basically just started cold calling and emailing companies with their personal Gmail accounts. Suzanne, it was incredible to hear Max Kennedy tell this story.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think he and his cohort, they went down there because they felt like so many of us in the spring of just, what can I do to help? And, setting politics aside, they went down there to, be a part of getting this vital PPE to the country and to hospitals. It was really shocking to hear his story and so many of the details. This idea that a bunch of 20-somethings, they didn't even go through background checks. They just sort of showed up. They were put into a room, and they were told to try to, figure this out. When it wasn't working, I think the most shocking thing was Max tells a story of one of his bosses coming in after attending a meeting with the president and saying, he's a marketing genius. He figured out a way to blame the states when we couldn't get PPE. And that was really disturbing to see how, this wasn't some kind of an effort to help the whole country, that they were still playing the blame game when we were all in it together.
Right. They also had to sign NDAs, and these young, inexperienced volunteers told Jared Kushner that these PPE manufacturers said, yeah, we know you want this, but another government showed up with a briefcase full of cash, so you need to pay up front. So they told Jared Kushner, we need to pay up front, and he said, fine, let's do it. And Max Kennedy Jr. said, at the end of the day, the team never purchased a single mask. Ophelia, it was also incredible to learn that they never purchased any PPE.
Exactly. I mean, when Max told us the story about the payment options that the government would offer, when he said, you know, the government would say, we will pay you 60 days after the goods arrive in the United States. When you think about it, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. All the countries, all the governments of these countries are scrambling to find PPE. Why would a company decide to sell to the United States without any upfront money when the other governments are giving the money upfront, right? So when you think about it, it's like, was the American government trying to get the PPE, or were they pretending that they, I mean, it's so mind-boggling. We have quotes from the FEMA reps in the film saying, oh, this is how usually the market works. We're not trying to disrupt how it works, but we're not in usual times. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We cannot operate as usual. We have to make decisions of how to actually cut through the bureaucracy, how to cut through the red tape to get things done faster and more efficiently. I mean, the fact that they didn't buy a single mask just tells you everything you need to know about that task force effort.
Right. Max Kennedy Jr. also says that when California Governor Gavin Newsom said that he needed testing swabs, Jared Kushner said that Donald Trump would grant the request on two conditions. Jared Kushner said Governor Newsom had to call Trump and ask him and then publicly thank Trump. What was your response when when Max Kennedy talked about that, Suzanne?
It wasn't Max Kennedy who actually told us that story, but there was sort of narration around it. We had a source who had actually been on the phone when that call happened. It's shocking that, this administration would use this as an opportunity to sort of, you know, ask Democratic governors to sort of bend to their will. I mean, this is supplies that you don't need to ask for. It should be getting, you know, distributed to hospitals and public health departments who need them. And the fact that, you know, Newsom had to publicly thank Trump in order to get that, it's not even Trump's decision to release the PPE. That's not in his jurisdiction. So the fact that was asked just seemed, it's just wildly out of line.
We also learned that in February, the Trump administration created the China COVID Procurement Service to encourage U.S. producers like 3M to sell their entire inventories of N95 masks to China. U.S. hospitals were forced to import them and pay up to 10 times more than the price charged by U.S. producers. We also learn that the U.S. government partnered with the five largest medical distributors, and once they shipped the mask to the United States, they were able to basically charge whatever they wanted. And that is why state governments said that they were bidding like they were on eBay. Ophelia, what really stood out for you when you learned about how this process actually unfolded?
What was really shocking to me was the fact that the American government didn't take advantage of their position. The federal government has the ability to monitor a lot of things. They could have still partnered with these five companies, but they could have decided where exactly they can sell these PPEs, where how much they can charge, up to what number. I mean, they didn't monitor and they didn't regulate any of that, right? And so these companies, the only requirement they had was that 50% of the goods had to be sold in the hotspot. But then the other 50 could be sold anywhere, even to other countries. I mean, they didn't regulate any of that. And when you think about it, it's like you have the federal government for this reason, to actually, in the crisis, to actually help monitor and not leave it up to the states. I think it was a huge failing to actually let it to the states to bid against each other, upping the price, and then bid against the FEMA. The government itself would bid against the state. It was just a hot mess the way this whole thing was handled.
Today we are joined by Ophelia Harutunian and Suzanne Hillinger, directors of the new documentary Totally Under Control. It is available on demand starting today. Before we go to a break, let's play a clip This is about masks and, you know, how this all unfolded and why it is so difficult today to still get PPE. I just got an email from a nurse who works in the Bay Area who said that they are still having a hard time getting N95 masks. So in this clip, you're going to hear from vaccine researcher Dr. Rick Bright, who is now a whistleblower, Michael Bowen, Executive Vice President of Prestige Ameritech, a U.S.-based mask supplier, the filmmaker Alex Gibney, Dr. Eva Lee, a researcher at Georgia Tech, and Representative Debbie Dingell questioning Michael Bowen at a hearing. Here is a clip from the documentary Totally Under Control.
Here's what we know.
I remember one day I was rounding in our COVID ICU, and our unit is structured kind of like a V, so there's one wing here, another wing over there. And, you know, these are some of the sickest patients I've ever taken care of in my life. They're on breathing machines, dialysis machines, and they're needing lots of medicines to keep them sedated and calm. And I'm trying to get through morning rounds. And I see that on one wing, it's almost all Hispanic last names. It's almost all Black names. I grew up an hour away from...
Without a large order from the United States government, there really wasn't an incentive for these companies to start maximizing their throughput. I was getting reports from Mike Bowen, one of the few remaining producers of face masks and respirators in the United States, who had his finger on the pulse of the supply chain.
I'm a salesman telling a story that nobody believes. The story is that the U.S. mask supply is going to collapse and people are going to die. It doesn't cost much to fix. That's the story. Around 2005, all of the major mask makers left the country. It put the U.S. mask supply in the hands of foreign control and could be subject to diversion during a pandemic. And that's what I've been warning about for years.
I wrote Barack Obama 20 letters. Tell America's hospitals that they are going to be in a position to not be able to protect their staff and their patients.
I voted for Donald Trump. I thought, you know, if I contact enough people in the administration, somebody, one of these people are going to look at this and go, hey, this is the problem. Maybe we ought to call this guy. And no, I couldn't get any. I didn't get any response there.
In January, Bowen's predictions came true. As China struggled to contain the outbreak of COVID, it limited the export of N95 masks to the United States.
At the end of January, I'm hearing from all over the world, people are freaking out about masks and needing masks. And that's when I got a hold of Rick and said, hey, here's what I'm seeing out here. This is going to be bad.
He was sounding the alarm bells almost every day.
Can't protect America's population. That's too late. But I said, I can at least make enough masks to protect America's healthcare workers. I reminded him that we had these four respirator lines. To activate them, we would need more people, raw materials, emergency NIOSH approval, and large non-cancelable orders. I see that our country's going to have a problem. I get a hold of Rick.
I pushed every one of those emails up to the Strategic National Stockpile and Critical Infrastructure Team. I reminded them of the H5N1 scare when people rushed to buy masks and hoard masks. The response I got, well, we will just change the CDC guideline. And we'll just tell people, don't do that.
Basically, in March, they realized that the healthcare workers are not going to have enough PPE. So they basically issue a warning to the public, do not use face masks.
Do you have any sense of how many more N95 masks would be on the market had the federal government taken you up on your offer to reactivate N95 manufacturing lines in January?
About 7 million N95 respirators per month.
I sounded the alarm every day about the shortage of N95 respirators, and we were doing nothing.
The numbers continue to surge in hotspots like California, Michigan, Louisiana, Florida, and especially, of course, New York. Medical resources are stretched to capacity and beyond.
Totally under control. We did reach out to Michael Brown, Executive Vice President of Prestige Ameritech, a U.S.-based mask supplier, to join the show. He said he couldn't join because he's in a meeting. But he wanted us to read a statement. He said the supply chain broke down because America's major mask makers moved manufacturing out of the U.S. around 2003. As you heard in the clip, he said, since 2007, I have warned the U.S. government and America's hospitals that the U.S. mask supply would fail in a pandemic because China and others would confiscate U.S.-bound masks in order to protect their own people, just like the U.S. government would and did do. Only the directors of BARDA and HHS and a few American hospital systems believed me. To avoid this disaster from happening again, it is imperative that American manufacture its own protective gear in the future. Now to the film. He says Totally Under Control is the most important film of our time. This documentary shows the real reasons why the U.S. has one of the highest COVID death rates in the world. Magical thinking is cause. Magical thinking continues to be a problem. The pandemic is real. Masks work. Believe the scientists. Well, we hope to have Mike Bowen on a future show because something needs to change in order for the United States to have a supply of masks. As I said earlier, we got an email from a nurse just last week who said they still do not have enough PPE. Today, we are joined by Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutunian, directors of the new documentary, Totally Under Control. It is available on demand starting today. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about a new documentary, Totally Under Control, which exposes the Trump administration's failed response to the COVID pandemic. Filmmakers Alex Gibney and today's guests, Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutunian, spent the past 5 months talking with scientists, doctors, and White House officials who have now become whistleblowers. The death toll has reached over 215,000 people, and experts fear that 400,000 people in the United States could pass by February. If you have any questions for Suzanne or Ophelia about what they found, you can watch the documentary starting today. It is on demand. You can find links at yourcallradio.org. And if you have Hulu, you can watch it there. Let's talk a little bit about the supply chain, Suzanne, or a little more. New York Times reporter Michael Shear in the film said filling the PPE stockpile in the United States has never been a priority. And there were so many calls to implement the Defense Production Act. Alex Azar on Fox said that they would rather work with vendors. And in the film, Alex Gibney says, let the market work its magic. This was the guiding philosophy for Azar and Trump. But their anti-government strategy really defied basic rules about supply and demand.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what this demonstrates is sort of the way that President Trump has, you know, one of his early campaign promises was that he wanted to run the government like, you know, one of his successful businesses. And I think you see that he then, you know, appoints people with similar mindsets like Alex Azar. But it's disturbing. And this is a moment, this is one of many moments that, you know, this is when you want the federal government to step up and use their power to do whatever they can to protect American people. And, you know, in terms of preparedness, we knew what we had to do. I mean, there was this exercise called Crimson Contagion that the Trump administration and many scientists, people from CDC and HHS, went through in 2019 and were able to identify that the stockpile did not have what we need if there was a respiratory virus that turned into a pandemic. And they didn't take anything from those lessons learned from that exercise to sort of be able to run with in January when we knew we had a serious outbreak.
What would you add, Ophelia?
I mean, there's a moment in the film, Kathleen Sebelius says in the end, you know, we spend billions of dollars on missiles that hopefully will never fly. We spend billions on weapons that hopefully we won't need to use a lot. We need to take, health of the public as, you know, seriously as we do, you know, arming the American army and the police and we need to be prepared for, I mean, there is going to be another pandemic. It's inevitable. And we need to just change our mindset and understand that public health is as important as other things that we spend billions on in this government. It is unfortunate that a lot of the PPE or the ventilators in the stockpile had expired 5 years ago and were never replaced. I think we need to just take this more seriously and change the way we look at public health.
And just last week, The Guardian has a piece about a 28-year-old Texas doctor, Adeline Fagan, who died of COVID. She tested positive in early July and died in September, and her family said she wore the same mask for weeks, if not months. And we are just hearing this over and over again of public health officials saying that they have no choice but to use the same PPE. In fact, Ophelia, we hear from a doctor in the film who said the same thing.
Yes, I mean, we have two doctors in the film, Dr. Bell and Dr. Rito. I mean, two different states, having the same experience with not having enough PPE. I mean, you said you got a letter from a doctor. We also are getting messages from doctors saying we still have this issue. Thank you so much for talking about this in the film. It is so unfortunate that our healthcare our healthcare folks can still not protect themselves. I mean, this is just the most basic thing that we need to do to protect the people that help us. And unfortunately, we're still not doing that months into this pandemic. I mean, knowing what we know and you would think that by now we would have this figured out. I mean, even testing. I know that getting a test, a PCR test, not the rapid test, which is less accurate, but the PCR test, at least in New York, takes about up to a week to get a result. And by then, I mean, you could have, infected other people. I don't know. I can't believe that we still have all these issues that we had in February and March.
And we'll talk about testing in just a couple of minutes, but I also just wanted to point to a lawsuit that has been filed by labor unions representing healthcare workers, teachers, transit operators, millions of frontline workers. They've joined with environmental groups to sue the Trump administration over its failure to provide adequate PPE. The suit was filed on October 8th. By a number of organizations. And we'll put a link to this lawsuit on our website and maybe do a show about it in the coming weeks. I was also struck by the interview that you did with infectious disease doctor, Dr. Jim Jing Yong in South Korea. And it was really striking, Suzanne, when he said, it is so sad to see the United States struggling with PPE, given that the United States created the N95 mask.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the U.S. historically has been looked upon by the rest of the world as sort of a leader in scientific innovation, as a leader in, you know, good healthcare. And, you know, even the U.S. CDC, it trained the Korean CDC, it trained a lot of other CDCs across the world in protocols and, you know, best practices. It's heartbreaking to hear that other people who, you know, would look to the U.S. for, the best way to do things, is seeing a fail.
Well, let's talk now about testing. In the film, we learn a lot about what happened in South Korea. On January 27th, South Korea summoned representatives from more than 20 medical companies to put in place a national testing program. The head of the equivalent of the CDC in South Korea basically said, manufacture these tests right now. Forget about the approval process. We will make sure that they're accurate. Within a matter of days, the first test was approved in South Korea, and there were only four cases at that time. By then, January 27th, South Korea was on its way to containing the virus and preventing an economic shutdown. Here in the United States, Alex Azar just continued to say, we got this, but there was no national plan in place. Ophelia, what really struck you when you looked at the differences between how South Korea responded and how the U.S. responded?
What was interesting was that South Korea actually learned from their mistakes. In 2015, they had the MERS outbreak in South Korea, which the government mishandled, and there were a number of mistakes that they made. And so they actually learned from their mistakes. They changed their legislation. They decided that, okay, this time around, when they had the same issue in their hands, they put all the bureaucracy and everything aside and said, you know, go ahead and create your own test. They told the private labs that they can go ahead and create their tests. They will approve them later, but they can start testing, trusting that these labs know what they're doing, because they realize the need for a test as soon as possible to see where the virus is and to be able to contain it. Whereas in the United States, there were so many labs that had created their own tests, but they couldn't actually run their tests because they were still not authorized to do it. They were still going through the whole bureaucracy with the FDA, getting the test approved. And so we lost about a month. For a month, we were not testing because, A, the CDC test had issues. It had a contamination issue, and they had to figure out how to fix it. And, B, we were not allowing the private lab to run their own test. And also, C, I mean, you can say that we were not using another test that, for example, the WHO had a German test that they were distributing. So we didn't quickly fix the issues that were there in early February. And as a result, we lost about a month of not testing and not knowing what the virus was. And then by the time we fixed the issues, the virus was already out of control and it had spread throughout the entire country.
And Suzanne, as you point out in the film, in South Korea, the politicians got out of the way and really let the scientists take charge. Here in the United States, we have political appointees with no public health experience. So we learn in the film that Dr. Robert Redfield, who was appointed by Donald Trump, he heads the CDC. He has no experience leading a public health agency. In fact, during the AIDS crisis, he preached a religious approach calling for abstinence as a solution. His attempt to push an unproven HIV vaccine was investigated for scientific misconduct twice. So that's the other main message, I think, in the film, is that you had other countries really rely on their scientists. In the United States, you've got people with absolutely no public health experience making major decisions.
Right. I mean, we don't know the details of exactly, how or why Dr. Redfield got, put as the CDC director. But what we've seen with other outbreaks, with Ebola and H1N1, is that, the CDC is supposed to be the forefront of communicating to the American people, and it's the scientists who have years of experience who are, in this particular instance, it should be respiratory experts who understand how this virus transmits. Somebody like Nancy Messonnier, who we saw silenced after she spoke the truth to the public. Those are the people who should have been communicating to us. And we saw over and over again over the last few months that, the White House has really been wanting to control the message. And when scientists did speak out, they were shut down.
Right. And Nancy Messonnier basically telling the public for the very first time in February your lives are going to drastically change. We're going to, you know, have to stay home with our children in order to get this under control. The stock market crashed after this happened. Trump was coming home from India and reportedly was so angry about this. Nancy Messonnier was no longer involved, and then Mike Pence was appointed to head the task force. Ophelia, what really struck you when you learned more about Nancy Messonnier?
Well, it was actually incredible how, how little actually the general public knows about Nancy Messonnier and the events that took place in February that kind of changed the course of the pandemic in the United States. In a way, someone could ask the question, if she hadn't broken the silence, how long would this misleading messaging had gone on before the public would actually find out the truth? What was unfortunate was that after she made that announcement, the CDC was silenced and the Trump administration kind of took over the messaging by appointing Vice President Pence. And so unfortunately that has been going on until now. We are starting to hear from some CDC officials a bit more in the recent weeks, but we're still getting very mixed messaging coming from the CDC and the White House.
So. And Suzanne, we also learned that Trump installed an official to censor or rewrite any CDC findings that contradict the rosy predictions of the White House.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we were sort of hearing through our sources at the CDC, people speaking off the record to us or sources close to the CDC were saying, when we were trying to get some people who were still working with inside the agency to speak with us, and they were saying, you know, people aren't going to call you back. People aren't going to respond to your emails. They really fear that their inboxes are being watched, that their phones are being tapped. They're scared that if they speak out against the administration, they'll lose their jobs. There will be some kind of retaliation. You know, we saw when Rick Bright spoke out to newspapers, he was, removed from his post. We did speak to Michael Caputo, who is, a very public, longtime Trump ally, and he was, put in position at HHS to, control the messaging and make sure that anything coming out of HHS or CDC was in line with what the White House wanted to endorse. I think that there has been a lot of censorship going on and it unfortunately has, cost lives because people listen to politicians, they listen to the government. And, when we have a president downplaying that, the importance of masks, there are no doubt people who are going to, take that as sound advice. Mm.
Today, we're joined by Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutyunyan, directors of the new documentary, Totally Under Control. The film is available on demand, and it'll be available on Hulu on October 20th. There are so many consequences. Obviously, more than 215,000 people have passed, and now scientists, Dr. Fauci was on CNN yesterday saying that he fears 400,000 people could die by February. And I just want to play a clip from Dr. Tyson Bell, who was on the front lines of the pandemic at the University of Virginia. He directly comes in contact with patients on a regular basis. And he talks about what his experience was like working with very, very sick patients who are dealing with COVID. Do we have that clip ready? Can we play clip one?
And here's what we know.
I remember one day I was rounding in our COVID ICU, and our unit is structured kind of like a V. So there's one wing here, another wing over there. And, these are some of the sickest patients I've ever taken care of in my life. They're on breathing machines, dialysis machines, and they're needing lots of medicines to keep them sedated and calm. And I'm trying to get through morning rounds. And I see that on one wing, it's almost all Hispanic last names. And then on the other wing, it's almost all Black names.
I grew up an hour away from where I'm working. These are the family names that I grew up with, and I know these families. And I just was trying to focus on the medical part and just getting through it, but I just felt this weight on my chest. I'm a Black male in the United States, and my family members have chronic diseases at high rates. And I've been dealing with this my whole life. And now I have family members who are contracting COVID. Those are smiles and hugs and tears and barbecues. They're not numbers on a paper.
That is Dr. Tyson Bell. He was on the front lines of the pandemic at the University of Virginia, talking about Latinos and Black patients who were some of the sickest patients he's ever taken care of. And I just also wanted to note that Faces of COVID is an incredible Twitter account, and they are remembering people who have passed. In honor of Indigenous Peoples Day, they tweeted about Native people who have died of COVID. For example, Helen Nez, a Navajo rancher and retired nurse, died of COVID in Arizona on June 8th. She's remembered for her deep commitment to keeping Navajo culture alive. Edna Raper, 67, of Oklahoma, died of COVID. She was an elder of the Cherokee Nation and a teacher who spoke fluent Cherokee. She said, when we lose our language, we lose our identity. A family member said COVID has been the single most threat to our language in this generation. And Suzanne, I thought it was important to play this clip because all of these people have stories, and a lot of people are saying, as a country, we're not mourning all of the people who passed. And, you know, Dr. Bell says that the majority of the patients that he's seen are Black and brown. And it is just so important to actually spend some time talking about these people who've lost their lives.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's really devastating how much this virus has exposed a lot of problems that we had in this country before the pandemic. You know, access to public health, you know, discrimination within the hospital. We've heard so many stories of, you know, people of color who went to the hospital with the same symptoms as a white person, and they were taken less seriously. And there's so much discrimination that has been uncovered that is really startling. And yeah, I mean, you know, our film was really trying to highlight what the government did in response and how we're all being affected. But there are certainly a lot of other documentaries and other stories coming out in all different mediums, you know, that will shed light. And it's important to honor the people who we lost. There have been so many.
Yeah, it's so, so important. We're going to dedicate a show to this. We have a number of emails from listeners who just wanted to thank you for this film. And again, Totally Under Control is available on demand starting today. And if you have Hulu, it'll be available on October 20th. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org and be sure to spread it around to your friends and family. We have a question from Stefan. Will you be appearing on talk shows and other news outlets to talk about this film? I mean, Suzanne, you've already done some interviews, but are you getting a lot of media requests from national media outlets?
We are, yes. I mean, our other director, Alex Gibney, was on The View yesterday with Dr. Rick Bright. But yeah, certainly lots of news programs, a lot of print journalism. So yeah, I mean, we're trying to get the word out about the film any way we can.
Stefan also says, has the Biden-Harris team seen this film? He writes, the president and government officials need to be held accountable, and with the general election coming up, time is of the essence. Ophelia, any idea if the Biden-Harris team or anyone they work with will be seeing this film?
We have not directly been in touch with them. We're not sure if the team has seen the film, but now that it's available today, hopefully they will get to see it.
And Hulu is going to be airing this on October 20th. What else are you doing, Suzanne, to ensure that as many people as possible see this film?
I mean, Neon, our distributor, has a great marketing team, and there's a lot of, you know, clips available online, trailers available online to see. But, yeah, you can watch the film by Video On Demand on Apple. I think shortly it'll be out on Amazon and YouTube. Neon also has its own on-demand platform. You can get it through, I mean, there are so many ways to be able to watch the movie. And then, yeah, it'll be out on Hulu shortly.
All right.
Just to quickly also add is our distributor is also working on making the film available for free a window before the election. So that information will come out soon.
Fantastic. And we will definitely announce that. Ophelia, it is really amazing to learn that a day after you completed this film, Donald Trump revealed that he tested positive for COVID-19. I can't even imagine what that was like for all of you to learn that news.
I mean, we're East Coast based, so our West Coast partners actually heard about it first and told Alex got a call from Tom Quinn, Neon's president, and asking, because we were planning to release the trailer the next day, and we had to decide whether to go forward with that or not. But it also, we woke up, Susan and I woke up to the news, obviously, in New York, and all three of us had to decide what to do with that information. We had just finished the film and we were ready to deliver, but we felt we could address it by just adding a card. We felt that the film, basically in the 2 hours, it does a good job telling the story, and we don't need to open it up to include this piece of information. But we did decide to add a card in the end to kind of address the news.
Anything to add, Suzanne? We have just about a minute left.
No, I think Ophelia got it. Yeah.
Well, it's so important for the historical record to really have all of this available for people to see. So Suzanne and Ophelia, thank you so much. And thank you to your team for putting this incredible film together in just 5 short months. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
us.
Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutunian are directors of the new documentary, Totally Under Control. Over the last 5 months, they have been interviewing scientists, doctors, and former White House officials who are now whistleblowers to find out what happened. Why did the Trump administration fail to respond to the COVID pandemic? The film is available today. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.